Okay, well, let's make a start. I'm Stephen Rose. I'm a neuroscientist, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how neuroscience and the world of high finance and journalism actually relate over this next half hour or so. But I've been listening to this past conversation that you've been having with Marcus. So let me start by asking you: if you'd been a banker, would you have got it right?
So I've just been asked, if I'd been a banker, would I have got it right? I mean, I never really wanted to be a banker, and I you know, so it's a sort of it's an odd. I just have to think about it for a second, really. I mean, I've been very worried about what has been going on for years. That's why I wrote the last book that I wrote, Who Runs Britain, because it was all about being concerned about the spectacular sums of money that were being made, as which I saw not as being bad in themselves, but as a sign that markets weren't working properly and that this was potentially quite a serious bubble that could harm us. I like to think that I would have got it right in the sense that perhaps, you know, what I was implying in that first question to Marcus is I instinctively mistrust models, maybe.
Oh, so do I. I'm a biologist. Models don't work on the whole.
And therefore, what I'm interested in is history and people, and I think as a banker, what a banker has to do is really pretty simple. But it has, you know, the banker has to see whether the individual or business who you're lending money to genuinely has the means to repay. And we got into a world where, and I don't know how much of all this we want to go over again, but we got into a world where the banker's relationship with the borrower disappeared because they thought that they had lovely models that meant that they didn't actually have to meet anybody to know whether or not that individual could repay the money. The model would just tell them they either were credit worthy or not.
Yeah, but look, you're a very unusual person. I mean, so here you are at the Roundhouse. I turned on my radio this morning and there you are on the day programme. I opened my Guardian this morning and there you are on the Guardian.
Now, poor you.
But that's actually a tribute to a particular sort of journalism, a particular sort of skill. And what's interesting me about this is, don't you want to change what's going on rather than just comment on it?
Gosh, this is a very dangerous question because I work for the BBC.
Well, of course it's a dangerous question. I was intending it to be a dangerous question. I'm a scientist.
What do I think? I think that, I suppose what I think in a very arrogant way is that if you provide, you know, what do I think I do? I think I provide information to people that they ought to know, that is useful to them. And I think if you do that, then even if it's only in a tiny little way, the world changes for the better. Because I just am generally one of those people who is a great believer in the power of knowledge and education and all the rest of it. And I think the more that people know that is useful, the better the world will be. So in that, you know, I'm not a campaigning person in a sort of party political sense. I mean, when I was political editor of the FT for a few years, and I had a famously, spectacularly terrible relationship with Alistair Campbell.
You and a lot of others, I suspect.
I wasn't the only one. But I think he found me particularly difficult because even as a journalist, he was a propagandist. He was absolutely clear in his mind that you were either Labour or Tory. And even as a journalist, every story was about promoting the Labour Party. And I just don't have that approach to journalism. My approach to journalism is, you know, you've got to screen out as far as possible, you know, those sorts of, you know, what you might call normative issues, as it were. Impossible to be completely impartial. It's impossible to get it completely right. But I think the role of the journalist is to try to do that and then let people make up their own minds. So I don't really, people thought I was going to be really frustrated going to the BBC, that I can no longer, in the way that I could when I was on the FT or the Telegraph, write a very opinionated piece or speak in a very opinionated way because of the BBC's traditions of neutrality. But actually, I don't feel particularly hemmed in, because what I mostly care about is presenting information that I think is relevant to people in a way that I think will allow them to make, you know, I may have views about what the right judgment to make on all of that is, but I have enough confidence in people that they will make the right judgment.
But the rumour mill suggests, for example, that if it hadn't been for you and your advance information, maybe the run on Northern Rock wouldn't have occurred. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's a separate issue. I mean, I think that as a journalist, the great challenge, particularly in my kind of area, and particularly a time of heightened anxiety, is not to become a player. You know, you want to be a commentator, you want to be you want to be the chorus, you don't want to be the actor. That's not to say that you don't have an impact on the world. Of course you do. I genuinely don't know, whether or not, if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't had that scoop, if I hadn't done that story, I don't know whether there would have been a run at Northern Rock or not. But I'm absolutely clear it was the right, that I did the right thing in broadcasting it, because this was a bank that was in difficulties, and people had a right to know that it was in difficulties. I've reviewed my broadcasts, and they were not alarmist. I mean, I absolutely said, both on the telly and the radio and in my blog, that actually I felt that the likely outcome of the Bank of England providing this emergency support would be that the bank would be all right. Actually, I think I gave Northern Rock rather too much of the benefit of the doubt, because it turns out that they were in even worse shape than I thought they were at the time. So I didn't produce a story in a sensationalist or alarmist kind of way. And I think the best way of in a curious sort of way of seeing, for me anyway, I don't know what other people think, that it was the right thing to do, is if you think about the situation where, in a sort of paternalistic kind of way, I've got this story, which I've been working on for weeks, actually. This was not a story that sort of was crystallised in an hour or two. I'd, broadly, the kind of markets that they depended on closed down in early August, I knew they were dependent on them. I knew that if things, somehow markets didn't turn up at a certain point, there would be a great crisis for them, and therefore I just monitored it. And I didn't, and until I was absolutely clear that this bank couldn't survive without taxpayer support, I didn't broadcast, because I didn't want to. If I'd broadcast earlier, that would have been sensationalist and alarmist. But as I say, if I turn it on its head and you ask yourself, let's just say that I knew that they were in dire straits and didn't broadcast because I didn't want to scare the horses, I think people would have seen that as, in a sense, well, I think that would have been me, in a paternalistic way, not acting as a journalist any longer, but making a judgment about, quotes, what's good for the world. And well, that, I think, is that's what you mustn't do as a journalist. That's,
well, I suppose that's quite difficult. I mean, I've always, as a biologist, as a political activist, or anything else, I've always assumed one's task is both to understand and to try to change the world, not just to comment on it as it is, in that sort of way. So it's a very specific thing, saying, I am going to comment on this without an agenda, without saying I want to change it, without saying in which direction I want it to go. I find that certainly not part of the sort of person I am, anyhow.
But you don't think that by highlighting, for example, which is what I think I did over that particular period, the tremendous risks that the banks had been running, you don't think that that contributes to a climate in which we reform things so that they don't behave in that way. You see, my, you know, in the end, the difference between you and me is what I won't do is I won't stand up and say, you know, the Tories have the right policy or Labour has the right policy or, you know, whatever I privately think about it. But I do think, as I say, to get back to where I started really on this, I do think if you supply people with, as far as you can, as much of the objective truth about what's been going on, they will themselves come to the right conclusion. So in that sense, it does seem to me that the difference between the two of us is more to do with approach than outcome.
That's possibly true, but that conflicts with the suggestion that, as it were, you don't want to change the world. I mean, presumably you do. We all want, in some sense, to get a right outcome, although we may have differences about what that right outcome is. I mean, in the banking issue, I mean, there's, as we know, there's a huge amount of anger about the way that it's been resolved at the expense of the majority of the population, and so far as we can see, not at the expense of the bankers themselves. Now, that cannot be a right outcome.
I think we've all, I think most of us, perhaps not all of us, you know, but I think most of us have quite a sort of strong, either conscious or subconscious sense of the good life, as it were. I think that does, you know, whether we want it to or not, shape the facts. You know, the presentation of the facts that one thinks are important. I mean, it is, you know, I mean, on something like the astonishing sums of money. Talking about them, you know, $15 trillion of taxpayers' money. And just actually, that's more or less just Europe and the US for bailing out the banking system. $2,000 for every person on the planet. Of course, you know, when people then see those rescued bankers pocketing millions of dollars and essentially pocketing them on the basis of the prop that we've provided them, it's not altogether surprising that people get angry. I suppose in a curious sort of way, one of the things that surprised me is that people aren't angrier.
I think people ought to be angry. I think it's obscene that someone should be taking back, what did you say, $1 billion, and there are 46 million uninsured people for healthcare in the United States. There are people on minimum wages in this country. There's a grinding level of poverty, and inequality has increased in Britain dramatically over the period of the Labour government. That seems to me to be obscenity, and that seems to me to be something where that cannot be the right outcome of any policies which are aimed at social justice rather than simply putting money in the pockets of the bankers.
I mean, it is interesting why in this country we have tolerated this widening gap between rich and poor. There's quite a lot of evidence that more equal societies are happier societies.
Indeed, the spirit level is a very interesting book from that point of view, the Wilkinson book,
yeah,
is it not?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I mean, and there have been a number of other studies. And so it is striking that, you know, in spite of the fact, as you say, we had a Labour government, that those gaps have widened very considerably. And I think we are at an interesting moment. I'm not sure. I mean, I do think this is quite a big moment. It's not clear to me whether the kind of shock to the system we've had will cause, in a sense, a collective rethink about how you incentivize people, how you motivate people. It does seem to me that in banking, we have a pretty good illustration that money on its own as a motivator doesn't do a terribly good job of creating outcomes that we think are beneficial. And yet we've replicated the banking model more or less everywhere. Public sector gives bonuses now, BBC gives bonuses. Almost everywhere you look, we have a sort of bonus culture and a culture in which people, you know, there's a sort of expectation that if you want people to do a bit better, you've got to reward them in money. It's interesting to me that in a fairly fundamental sense, that's not being questioned at the moment.
Well, I think it ought to be questioned because I think it has a devastating effect, both in terms of the broader effect on the increase in inequality in society, which makes society, which is an increase in unhappiness, an increase in ill health, an increase in violence, and all of those things that we know. But it also means that what it's doing is wrecking those institutions, which actually, for some time, I thought in Britain were particularly strong. I mean, it is disastrously having an effect on the universities at the moment, just as it is on everywhere else, on teaching, on and this is the result of the last 20 or 30 years. It doesn't go back simply to the 1997 and the glorious morning in which the son of Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister of Britain. It went back long before that, but it's still something which it's been very miserable to see as a sort of decline in public service, a decline in senses of social justice over those decades. And I think that's something which is profoundly worrying.
I mean, I hate it, you know, it's invidious to mention it, but I mean, you know, that the last book I wrote was largely about this.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was about the rise of the notion, you know, of the idea that the only way you can motivate people is with money, the decline of the notion of public service as a sort of good in itself, as it were. I am struck that there is no national debate about any of this, and you'd think there would be, in the wake of the kind of crisis that we've been living through.
Maybe people feel they can't do anything about it, that we live in a globalised world, that the banks are global, industry is global, and nation states can't do much about it, governments can't do much about it, so why bother to vote?
I mean, it is certainly the case that there is a massive democratic deficit at the moment, in the sense that so many of the issues that really matter to us are global issues. Reform of the banking system actually is probably more important to our future prosperity than, you know, almost anything else that gets politicians excited in this country, like whether or not taxes go up and down, for example. In terms of, you know, future economic stability, we've got to get this right. But this is not something that national governments feel they can do. So decisions on this get kicked up to international fora like the G20 and to committees of regulators who typically, I mean, the most important one is called the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which sits in a Swiss town and has been sitting there as a very important committee for more than 20 years and was largely responsible for getting the rules spectacularly wrong and creating the crisis in the first place. And we're now looking to that same committee, which got it wrong the first time round, to get it right. But one of the things that I find disturbing, one of the things I've been trying to sort of make a bit of a noise about recently, is on this issue that matters to all of us, there is absolutely no democratic input whatsoever. There's very little debate about it nationally, and it's, you know, it's not something politicians really talk about in a sophisticated way. It's not something that, you know, that any of us really have much of an impact on. We have broadly, there's a sort of an elite class of brainy bankers and regulators who we have unconsciously delegated these decisions to. And that makes me profoundly uncomfortable. We delegated the decisions to them the first time around, they got it wrong. We're now trusting them to get it right. And I'm not sure whether we are right to trust them to get it right. This happens to be my own particular, obsession. But of course, you know, on the environment, these again have to be international decisions. They can't, you know, no one country can fix that problem. Increasingly, taxation is something that is a global issue. Why is it that governments in this country don't feel able to raise corporation tax or raise income tax, even though there are some who think that maybe that is the right thing to do. It's mostly because they're terrified that companies are going to move to lower tax countries and individuals are going to move to lower tax countries. So again, if you wanted to, you know, really, you know, debate tax in a way that was rational in, you know, in creating what you would think of as being the good life, you would want international agreement on these things, which is very rarely forthcoming. And so I think you're right. I think you know, we live in a you know, in a world where we are terrified of losing our so-called national sovereignty, and there's a, you know, the rise and rise of a sort of nationalist element in political parties. But so much of what needs to be fixed actually can only be fixed if we're a bit more relaxed
It really is an extraordinary contradiction, that the rise of nationalism and the impotence of national governments. But of course, from where I'm coming from as a scientist, what I see is the development of what I would call the techno-sciences, because everything we do is not divisible now between pure science and technical applications of it. They are integrally linked into one another. And that too has become part of a global phenomenon. And the globalization of capital has also meant the globalization of science. You regulate in one area, try, for example, to regulate the use of human embryos, or to regulate on informed consent on how people should actually be treated, and you get stem cell tourism, or you get the research being shifted from one country to another. Clinical trials at the moment of drugs which are going to be used in Britain are outsourced to be done in China, or outsourced to be done in Eastern Europe, because it's cheaper to do the trials there. The regulatory controls are much less. And we live in this incredibly footloose sort of environment. And it's a footloose environment which affects not just the science or the research that is done, but of course the people themselves. I suspect I'm rather unusual amongst my fellow scientists, and that I've spent almost all of my research career in Britain, rather than hopping off to spend 3 years in the States or 5 years in Germany or wherever else it might be. So this is, again, just as capital has become footloose and bankers have become footloose, so science has become footloose as well.
Can I just ask you a question, which is possibly a terribly trite question, but so forgive me if you do think it is. One of the great failures of modern economics, and indeed which contributed to the great financial crisis that we've lived through, is that so much of the models that banks and regulators use, and indeed that governments rely on, is based on the notion, well, is based on an economic model that assumes that people are rational. So I just wondered, given that it's, you know, anybody who's spent any time living, it's a perfectly obvious case that people aren't on the whole rational, whether you've ever had a lively conversation with any of these economists about the nonsense that they build their models on.
The nonsense of rational choice theory. Well, it's actually interesting you should ask that, because there are, with the development of certain brain imaging techniques at the moment, there's an increasing interest in putting people into subjects into these big scanners and confronting them with economic questions. Questions about how they would invest their money, questions about gambling games, for example, and trying to image those regions of the brain which might light up. And the suggestion, for example, that you can find two sorts of individuals based on slight gene differences, some of whom are more reckless than others and are prepared to gamble in a way that others aren't. And the idea that rational choice theory should be embedded in the brain in this sort of way seems to be completely nonsense. Slowly, 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 the images are becoming to recognize that there's a bit of emotion involved in this as well. I mean, I learned this very early on, I have to say. I started as a chess player, which I thought was a purely cognitive activity. And then, you know, I was playing chess at sort of quite high levels at university, at national, international level, and so on, when I was young. And I discovered there were people who would always psych me out. I was always going to lose to this particular person, irrespective, when I started. So forget all this sort of purely cognitive stuff. Go for a game of pure competitive psychology. Yeah. So I took up poker, and I suspect that's what a lot of bankers have done as well.
Well, I think that, you know, the basic point you make, which is that when things are going well, we all have this propensity to think things are going to go on well forever, and it, you know, and it is an emotional thing, and so much of the sort of overshooting of markets has been emotional, In that sense, overshooting both when they're rising and when they're falling.
But the claim somehow is that, which is coming out of this and coming out of a new sort of science called evolutionary psychology, that these ways of behaving are locked deeply into humans' evolutionary past, and these regions of the brain which are genetically wired in and light up in those magic false colour pictures that you can see all over. When they're not showing markets doing this and this, they're showing skulls with bits of brain lighting up in particular areas, and they are at least as misleading. I think we've got to get beyond that sort of thought, and we've certainly got to get beyond rational choice theory and the idea that that humans are homo economicus.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely absolutely right. I mean, the problem, the challenge, of course, for economists is, given that it was so embedded in so many of these models, there is a bit of a crisis at the moment about, how on earth, what on earth replaces it. We are a hell of a long way, actually, there is a serious intellectual crisis for economists at the moment, and... one of the things that is quite frightening for somebody like me is you get three Nobel Prize winners in a room talking about what went wrong and where to go, and you get three completely different answers.
Well, it may be that the economists are now turning to the neuroscientists rather than the mathematicians. There is a new field called neuroeconomics.
There is.
Which you'll know about indeed, which attempts to locate in intrinsic aspects of human behaviour, the way that the markets behave. I think that might be fine for microeconomics. I don't think it's actually going to touch the macroeconomic issues.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that whole discipline is, as you say, seems to be actually quite useful for government policy. I mean, there's a slightly big brotherish element to it because, and it's particularly fashionable at the moment within the Tory party, this notion that, we're sort of pre-programmed to... operate in certain ways, and therefore if you provide certain kinds of incentives to people, you'll get benign outcomes rather than bad ones. So the classic, I suppose, example of a policy that actually this government has adopted, it's going to be introduced quite soon, which they hope will produce the right outcome. They were very frightened of compelling people to save more for their pensions because they thought that would look like taxation, and this is a government that doesn't look like taxing. So what they've done is they've introduced a system which I think comes in about 2 years, where if you work for a company, you will have to opt out of making a pension contribution rather than having to opt in. And on behavioural studies, they've concluded that people are less likely to opt out than they are to, you'll get more people saving if you ask them to opt out rather than if you ask them to opt in, because we're either lazy or, we just somehow think that if the company thinks it's a good thing for us, the government, will do it, as it were.
Or you throw the bit of paper away, but we've lost it.
Or whatever. It's a sort of mild paternalism, which, and it's sort of a nod to certain ideas of freedom. I think arguably, that kind of thing might be useful, but it doesn't, at the end of the day, tell you much about how to run the economy as a whole.
Well, indeed not. But the crucial question for all of us is that, it seems to me, for scientists, for economists, for civil society as a whole, how we get hold of this, how we deal with the democratic deficit that you're actually referring to. That means finding ways of, firstly, enabling people to believe that they have power over their own destiny, that the choices you make are choices which will affect the way you live, and not just throw up your hands because we can't do anything about it. And that seems to me to be a tremendous problem at the moment. I don't think we have the answers as to how to do that.
Well, I think there are two issues, aren't there? I mean, one of the issues is quite a lot of these big questions can't be solved by individual governments. The other is the world is quite complicated. Why have I quite enjoyed the last couple of years, which I probably shouldn't have done given that it was obviously a time of some turmoil? I'll tell you why I enjoyed it.
Oh, come on, it's because, entitled to be on a high about it.
I'll tell you why I enjoyed it. It's because, as luck would have it, one of my very first, my very first job, which I hated at the time, was as a banking correspondent. This was back in 1982-3. And I had to learn back then all about sort of, essentially about how banks work. And I thought it was incredibly tedious. But as it happens, it turns out to have been fantastically useful because over the past few years, it did allow me to understand things that were going on in the world that were, turned out to be incredibly important to everybody, as it were. And actually, there is something fantastically, one of the things I hope I've done, because it's the thing which gives me most, most pleasure, is what I've tried to do is take these issues which people have historically said, oh, no, that's, can't frighten the children, this is too complicated for people, we're not going to, nobody ever talked about capital ratios or banks' capital or banks' liquidity or any of this kind of stuff, outside of very specialist publications.
So what would be the test of your success, that you had actually managed to sort of move things forward, change things?
Well, I mean, partly it's just the sheer number of people who, for example, read my blog, and only in the sense that it's some of it's quite complicated stuff, and it's and certainly a few years ago it would have been stuff that people would have thought was incredibly boring, and the fact that people do want to read it suggests to me that there is a hunger to understand these things, and that seems to me to be a very something which is intrinsically positive. I can't, without wishing to divulge too much because of what I do, about how I think the system should be reformed. I'm not yet in a position to know whether, in the end, if you get back to what you originally asked me, the kind of job that I do has had a positive outcome, because I don't yet know whether the reforms that I think are necessary will happen. And we're not going to know that for another 6 months or so. The pace of reform has been quite slow. There is no doubt in my mind that the international economy needs quite significant reforms. And I don't yet know whether the right reforms will happen. I mean, there is a big risk here if these reforms don't happen. And the other thing which is going on, if we don't solve some other structural problems like the level of debt in this economy, we could be in for a pretty ropey period. I mean, we could be in for, years and years of very little growth and potentially economic crises.
Well, of course, some people would argue that being in for a limited period of economic growth was a good thing because it might be better for the environment. It might increase the chance of the human race surviving to the end of this century.
I mean, you certainly raise a very good point that our obsession with absolute levels of growth per economy has always seemed to me to be slightly odd. People talk, for example, about the great crisis in Japan, and it's true that over a 15-year period, the overall level of growth in Japan was very low. Individual Japanese people, however, are phenomenally wealthy compared to, people in this country, for example. Yes. And more interestingly,
when growth actually means, for instance, more cars on the road, yep, less public transport, more private transport, more flying, more third airports and so on, that growth is actually calculated only in economic terms.
Absolutely right.
That's actually not a satisfactory way of calculating.
I completely agree with you that we are spectacularly bad at capturing all the long-term costs of a particular method of running an economy. And I would therefore, of course, agree with you that this fixation on the traditional measure of 3% GDP growth as somehow being what we've got to strive for is not helpful. We are hopeless at capturing the cost of environmental damage.
Because we can't model it. I mean, because it's too complicated.
Partly because we can't model it, and partly because it is amazing even now, even when there is extraordinary scientific consensus about what's going on, that somehow it's regarded as political to build any of that stuff into your economic models. It's very odd.
And the half-life of politicians is a few years, and the half-life of climate change is a good deal longer than the duration of any given parliament or any given government.
I mean, in your area, can I ask you, we talked about sort of one measure of progress that many people think is misleading, which is the notion that somehow absolute levels of economic growth are somehow intrinsically good. Do you think, as somebody who is an expert on the brain, that in general we're becoming brainier?
I think we're adapting to new technologies. But that doesn't mean the brain is evolving, it just in the sense that it's changing its structure, it's changing its genes in that sort of way. But the sort of world we live in, the sort of things we do with our brains now are qualitatively and quantitatively different from what they were in Victorian society.
But is there any empirical evidence that we're wiser?
Now, wisdom's a very different question. I think wisdom has to do with brains.
If you put a wise person's brain in one of your scanners along with somebody who was, you know, clever but plainly, you know, not in that sense wise, would you see any difference in the brain patterns, do you think? answer. Yes or no.
Perfect timing. Not allowed to answer that question.
That's shocking.